Hello, so welcome to Secrets of Desperate Performers. I'm Sabrina George, and I'm your chair. I'm the anger statement for today. And I'd like to first of all introduce you to Aisha Hazarika, who's a stand-up comic who's also doing a show in this venue at 10 past 8 in this venue. Two birds go into a bar.
Yeah.
Very, very good stand-up. Done very well in many competitions, etc. She's also won Asian Woman of the Year, which we shall might come up in conversation, I'm not sure. And does lots of other fabulous things. And Ruth Blatt, who is also a stand-up comic. You've got actually quite a handful of shows. Do you want to quickly say what they are?
I'm doing All In Broadway this year. I've got the reduced end of the fringe at 12:30, which is at Seas Central. And we've got the Soap Kitchen, which is in Five Stables at 6 o'clock here. And in Providence, which is a bit like these lines anyway, and that's here, but it changes every day.
Because it's improvised, you can't keep to it.
I don't even know what I'm going to do.
Improvised times as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fantastic. Well, one of the questions that I get asked mainly is the stand-up. I've got actually quite a broad background as a performer and a director and designer. I started off in fringe theatre, moved into mainstream theatre, worked in opera, and I've worked in television and in film, and I'm now doing stand-up. And I'm also involved in the producing capacity of the stand-up as well. So I've got quite a broad background in it. And a lot of people after gigs, they come up and they say, God, that's the most frightening thing I can imagine. I always think that's a bad sign. I think it's a bad sign. Someone said, that's the most scary thing I can possibly imagine. You are so brave. And I have to say, the first 10 months I did stand-up, I still don't know why. I don't really have an answer. I died. A great friend of mine, Jay Studegar, crowned me queen of dying, which means that you get no laughs and you get no heckling. People actually look at their feet rather than look at you, hoping you will quietly walk off stage and disappear and something more interesting will come along. But there is a point where you actually get, for me anyway, I completely got over those nerves and I got better as a result. But I think it was nerves that was actually making me die a lot. When I get frightened, I look very scary. And audiences are just like, oh, like that. So it was a process of the nerves went away, the gigs got better, the nerves got less, the gigs got better. And that's how it happens. And at the moment, I don't feel what I do is particularly brave. I think that initial bit was very, very brave. Now, looking back, at the time, I was just curious. I was just saying, why am I generally a funny person and not managing to do it in front of an audience? So, Ruth, what's your response to something like that?
Well, I hate it when people say, oh, why it's so brave, but I don't really think it is. I just quite like kind of showing off at the moment, so it's always quite nice for me to sit down there. I just die awfully in places like Western Superman, and people will be sitting there in these awful worst men's clubs, and they all just stare at me and then start talking amongst themselves because I didn't say rude words very often, and that's what they wanted. And I think you just have to kind of ignore it in a funny way. You know, you get past it. I still do. I died the other night. It's a horrific death. Somewhere up here, it was appalling. But that's, you know, that's not bravery, that's just if you put yourself out there to show off, and sometimes you've got to accept that people aren't like it.
Do you think there's anything that you do is particularly courageous? I don't think just being up there is courageous for me, it's trying to actually push the boundaries of religion.
I think the improv scares me more than anything, because you never know what's going to come up, and you never know what's going to come out of your mouth.
You never know where it is.
Yeah, I don't know where it is.
What time it starts.
I suppose, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff I say is going to offend some people. And I think the bravest thing you can do is not compromise on what you're saying. And if you believe that what you're saying is funny, which I do,
I make myself laugh.
So, yeah, if you believe it's funny and you just keep doing it regardless of it, I suppose that's quite brave. It might be stupid too. You know, sometimes it might be nice to do something that makes everybody laugh, but it's the best thing that's possible. So I suppose, yeah, pushing boundaries and, you know, saying things that some people find uncomfortable and, you know, I suppose, yeah, accepting the fact that some people are just going to be offended by what you're saying or aren't going to like it or... I'm going to laugh, I suppose that is, that's, you know, probably heart surgery or anything like that. Just
except for your own.
Yeah.
What about you, Aisha?
Well, when I first started comedy, I think, like everybody, it's just so desperately painful. And, of course, the first gig I did a course in stand-up comedy, and the first gig I ever did was at, like, a comedy club, and it was, like, the graduation night, and everyone's friends and family came down. So the first gig absolutely stormed it, and I came off stage thinking, I'm a comedy genius! I absolutely stormed my first gig! And then, of course, you go out into, like, a proper gig, and you're playing to, like, heart-stopping silence, and you're like, is this on? Is this on? Because it killed last week, kind of thing. And it is hard when you start, and you have to... You become... I mean, in order to sort of keep going with stand-up, you have to become immensely resilient, and you have to just accept that for a certain period of time you're going to be learning your craft, and you are going to have periods where you absolutely die. And you die so badly on stage, you can't even make eye contact with people when you're leaving. It's that bad. But, you know, what will kill you makes you stronger, and you learn more from a bad gig than you do from a good gig. And you just get better. But it does make me laugh when people say things like, God, you're so brave. It's not that brave getting on stage. I went to Baghdad, that was brave. That was brave. Getting up on stage with a glass of wine, that's not that brave.
When did you do that?
It was just after the war ended. And I worked in the government at the time, and they were like, hey, you're employee of the month, do you want a trip out? I did. We were organising a women's political conference, and I had to go out to Baghdad to organise it. That was scary.
What was it like?
Just terrifying. I mean, got to the airport, and you have to fly in from Kuwait in a big B-52, and it's got things like tanks in them, and it's like something out of a war film. And I was there with my little wheelie trolley, really in a like, really inappropriate outfit on. I don't know what I was thinking in my head. And you fly into Baghdad, and they don't have a proper airport, they've got a military airport. There's one road that goes from the military airport to the coalition base. It's the most vulnerable security point because there's only one kind of road, and that's where snipers lie. And so I kind of landed, and there's no sort of, you know, nice airport. You literally land in a field, and then it's like three massive lopes that look like something out of a Vietnam War film come up to you, and you get given like a steel helmet and a black jacket. And they say to you, you might get shot along the way. If you do get shot, just go down and sort of lie on the ground. And if we get shot for any reason, we've got these, like, funny GPS navigation systems, and if you key in this code, you'll be able to... And I'm thinking, I can't even work the timer on my video, let alone kind of work out my satellite navigation point in the event of a massive shooting. It was awful. It was just really... Some of those things were... I was really glad I did it, and it was a useful thing to do, and made you really appreciate living in a democracy, because this whole thing was to try and get women involved in politics. And women had travelled from all parts of Iraq, you know, risking life and limb. And one of the women that we got onto sort of the equivalent of like the first council got shot kind of quite recently, and she died. So just made it kind of one of those things where when I was on the plane home, I thought, I'm really glad I've done that. But at the time, it was just panic-wettingly scary.
And it made a big sense, seeing completely without any worry about nerves or...
It does put things in perspective a bit. I think a lot of comedians... You can think that what you're doing is the most important thing in the world, and quite clearly it's not. Like, quite often you're just getting drunk and going up on stage and entertaining some stag doos and stuff like that, so...
It's scaring the different ones.
Yeah.
Right, quick vote from the audience. Who do you think is the most honest? Rupert? No votes, darling. What about Aisha? Yeah. You have to vote on somebody.
Yeah.
No, who has been the most honest? There is only one answer to that. Vote on Aisha. Alright, let's call that a draw.
Actually, I made all that stuff about Baghdad. I've never been in my life. No, you can make that.
Do you remember again, I'll go back to myself to give you thinking time. The next question is sort of what the moment that you remember actually being prepared to take the action to be a stand-up rather than thinking about it or dreaming about it. I'd worked in lots of different areas, as I've said in the past, and I'd been turned down for an Arts Council grant for a project I was doing, and these two real heavy drinkers next door to me invited me over to cheer me up and suggested I did a workshop in stand-up comedy, and I just thought, that sounds like so irresponsible and so much fun. I'm going to mess around for about 3 months doing this. And I did this course, which I have to say was excellent. It's produced a lot of our Jimmy Carr was on it, and Shazia Mars and various other people on it, but now become very well. It's a very well-run course. And it wasn't playing around at all. I don't think we had a laugh in 3 months. We all sat there terribly importantly listening to the deconstruction of material and stuff like that. And I was actually very intrigued by that. It felt more like an algebraic equation rather than messing around. And as I say, I then did my first gig to Total Silence and proceeded to do that for quite a few months before getting a little bit further up the ladder. But I sort of fell into it backwards and then became more and more intrigued about it. I've never been to a stand-up comedy gig before I went to one as a comic myself, which is, I think, quite unusual. I'm not sure how many people have done that, but I'm just wondering, I'll start with Aisha. What was your moment of switching?
Well, I think mine was a bit of a... I just sort of felt quite dissatisfied with my life. I was kind of working as a civil servant, which is probably why I was really dissatisfied with my life, to be fair. And I just sort of had this kind of feeling that I wanted to try and do something different with my life and just something creative. I didn't know it would be stand-up comedy. I thought it might be comedy writing or something like that. And I sort of got into this habit of going out after work and drinking a vat of wine and crying every night about like the fact that my life was really dull. And sort of seemed to make people laugh while I was doing it. And someone said, quite a few people sort of said to me, you should think about doing kind of stand-up because your drunken rants are quite amusing. Obviously no one offered any support or help. They were just laughing at me. And which is nice. And then I saw a course advertised in stand-up comedy. And I think a group of friends from work just got sick of my whinging and just said, well, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Instead of going on about how you want to change your life and do something different, why don't you try this course? It looks fairly kind of harmless. And then that's how I decided to sort of do it. I hadn't really been to that many stand-up. I'd been to a couple of stand-up clubs before, but always felt like the world of stand-up comedy was completely impenetrable. You know, it was so far removed from any of my reality. Most of the clubs I've been to, I've never seen a woman on stage, certainly never seen a brown woman on stage, and certainly, you know, it didn't seem like it was a world that had any place for me. So doing this course, and I really enjoyed it, that's when it suddenly became a bit of a reality, a possibility.
So seeing that ad?
Yeah.
Picking up the phone and taking it from there. What about you, Ruth?
I suppose for me, I've been acting for 7 years, or 6 years, and it was just sick of it, you know, because you don't actually act and you're left to do your day job.
Temp.
Yeah, I typed a lot. And I just got kind of sick of that, and I came up with, I just split up with my fiance and was in a real, you know, and decided to go a little bit mental, really. And I came up here two years ago and doing play in a lift. And one of my best mates had just done the course that I used, and was always going on at me to do it, because we used to do murder mysteries together, and that's very, in lots of ways, very similar, because we've got, you know, a drunken audience who want to be entertained and heckled quite a lot, and you have to put them down and, you know, improvise around them. And she kept saying to me, do it. And I came up here and I just had this wild Edinburgh, you know, with poetry and all sorts. And I met so many comedians and just had a lovely time and thought, actually, maybe I will. And so I went on the course that Aisha went on. This is really different from the one you went on, I think. It was brilliant because it was 3 or 4 hours a week where you could just be creative. And there was no one saying that what you were doing was wrong, or although one guy did really offend an American woman by making a joke about twin powers, which I thought was hilarious, and there was a big fight on the course. Yeah, it was brilliant. But yeah, you could just be creative for 3 hours a week and just muck around and have a laugh, and then yeah, it was, that the turning point was really coming up here and just thinking, actually, I'm going to do this. And I also think for women going into stand-up comedy, you've got more of a chance of getting somewhere quicker than women going into acting. Because stand-up comedy doesn't depend on what you look like. Whereas I think acting still really does, you know. And I remember talking to someone once and saying, and they were saying, well, you're not pretty enough to be a leading lady and you're not fat enough to be a character actor. So you either need to cut off some weight or lose a lot. And I sort of went, I don't know if you want to do that. And doing this, you know, within what I've been doing for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, what I've achieved doing this has been 20 times what I've achieved, you know, in 7 years of working in just god-awful film productions and going to, you know, auditions where people ask you to polish a piece of art that isn't really there. And then ask you if you ever feel embarrassed on stage. Well, yeah, obviously I do. You know, and try to psychoanalyze you. And just walking around becoming bitter and twisted about all these idiots that you meet and you're putting on shows and barren support theatres. So, yeah, that was the turning point for me. I think sheer desperation.
That's more using the term desperate. You can be desperate at what you have done rather than just desperate. So quick round then, the vote. Aisha, who's been the most honest? The most honest. Aisha, Hazarika. Brilliant. One vote. And Ruth?
Good. I think that it's
going to be
the
truth.
Up to them. I have no control. I have no control whatsoever. The next question is to do with background. Is there anything about either of you, about yourselves or about your background or something particular that you use as a springboard into your comedy? I have an eclectic background. My father's been married 8 or 9 times. Both my parents are South African. Not very nice people. I don't think you've met any. Yeah, nasty people. And and I was born in Canada. My parents were hippies. They were travelling around and ended up being brought up in a sort of commune in Sussex. And I speak the way I do, and how I present myself to the world is actually a device, if you like, because it's nothing to do with my background. And I love bringing that element of my background into what I'm doing about comedy and my view of the world. I have no moral code whatsoever in South African past, and both my brothers have spent time in prison, and I'm a white collar, I have been a white collar criminal myself. How my father never got incarcerated, I'm absolutely amazed. But it is to do with presentation, and I love messing around with that. I'm also a very good MC. I really enjoy messing with an audience and bringing out of the audience and comedy as well and playing with that. And that's sort of where I come from. I enjoy that sense of play that you get. And coming from my background, I have quite an eclectic amount of knowledge. I can nearly always find something I can connect with the audience over that. And that's one of the things I really enjoy about myself that I bring to the table each time. What about, and I'll start with you, Ruth.
I don't know if there's anything particularly in my background.
Her parents are in the audience for those on
there.
She might not. She has got parents.
Yeah, I didn't just come from an egg. Well, I did come from an egg, obviously, everyone does, don't they? Not a chicken egg.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. I don't know. I think I don't really comment on myself or my background in my stand-up. My housemate called it me at my most miserable, and I've got too much time on my hands. You know, if you think about something too long, you just make nonsense out of it, and that's where it all comes from. It's just me sitting there and thinking too hard about things. And also, you know, I do find the world quite absurd. That definitely comes from my parents. You know, they're vulnerable. They're definitely vulnerable. And
they don't really pride.
Well, I called my dad to down the train on telly. I think he's used to it by now. But I don't know, but I don't really talk about that. I had a very, you know, boring, happy upbringing. We're still together, they've been together for 30 years, my brother's, there's 6 years there's a 6 year. My brother's very stable and very normal. Doesn't drink though. That I suppose that's the one weird thing in my family. My brother doesn't drink and everyone else can fish. And he's the most outrageous of everyone. He got up at my birthday party a couple of years ago, stone cold sober, no one else had started the karaoke, and he stood in the middle of the sitting room with his karaoke machine that didn't have any Neil Diamond on it and sang Reverend Blue Jeans.
That's he on class E drugs, he's not drinking, he's on something else.
He's got that, no shame. I think he's the performer, actually, out of both of us. He's much more outgoing, and I suppose that's what I bring from myself to the stage. I'm very, I don't like meeting people, and I don't like talking to people I don't know. And I don't like, so I kind of put a wall there that's, I'm quite dour on the main stage, that's what I'm called, dour. And downbeat. And that's, I suppose that's what I bring to it, is that I don't really like people very
much. Great source of comedy. Fantastic.
My hatred of people.
What about you,
boys? Nice to meet you all, you're very welcome. I think my background has affected my comedy quite a lot, because I do draw quite heavily on my set about the fact that I grew up in Glasgow and in quite a rough part on the outskirts of Glasgow, and we were like the only Asian family there and really only Muslim family there, and we were like, it was just a bit of an odd kind of situation to be brought up in. And my mum and dad were very determined to sort of let us decide what we wanted to be. And so we did have this kind of really mixed upbringing. So on one hand, it was really traditional kind of Indian Muslim. And on the other hand, it was like absurdly Scottish. And we had this thing on a Saturday morning where my mum would take me and I'd go and like learn to read the Quran. And then I'd go and go to Scottish country dancing lessons and just like weird things like that. And so I do talk about that in my set quite a lot, that because I think it's kind of funny, a lot of the sort of contradictions in my upbringing. I guess my parents are kind of, I think in their own way they are performers themselves, but because they're kind of Asian, it was just never ever perceived as something you could make a kind of a career out of, because it wasn't like being a doctor, a lawyer or an accountant. And when I was sort of at school, if I could have chosen what I wanted to do at university, it probably would have been drama or something like that, but there was absolutely no way that was going to happen. My mum said, like, we've not come over to this country for you to pretend to be a tree for like kind of 3 years at university. You will go and study law, so that's what I had to do. So I think that's probably what I get from my kind of parents. My dad, I think, secretly harbours a desire to he's always telling, like, the worst jokes in the world. Like, his favourite joke in the whole world, which he puts on with, like, kind of an Asian Scottish accent, which is just ridiculous, is a man walks into a shop and he says, "Is that a donut or a meringue?" And the person goes behind the counter, "No, you are correct, that is a donut." "A meringue, am I wrong?" No. Favourite joke.
Bless. I love your dad already. Has he ever tried to do a gig?
No, he keeps saying that if I ever get married, that's going to be his big chance to like, do his first gig.
So you're not going to get
married? No, I'm never getting married ever.
Very, very good. So quick round then. Who thinks that Ruth has been the most honest? And Aisha.
Hey!
Fantastic. We're on an
all
even...
Lie. Not even Indian. I'm Swedish, can you tell?
I mean, this is like one of those, this is a sneaky way of asking the question, that, you know, what sort of writing do you do? What would you like to do? If you could be another performer or have written some material that another performer would have done, who would it be? in my case, there's sort of quite, I mean, my absolute idol, and I know so little about her, but I think she's absolutely fantastic. She's nothing like me, for anyone listening, is Mae West, who wrote all her own material, all her own films. She wrote many, many successful plays. She's first virtually disappeared off the comedy map. And she owns most of the land that Hollywood was built on. She made so much money. She's phenomenally successful. And seemed to have a really, really good time. She didn't disappear. She was a comedian. She was a comedian. No, stage work. I've done my research. we don't actually have that much in common apart from being female, but she was incredibly innovative in what she did. She wrote loads and loads of boundaries. She was constantly in trouble with the censors for what she did. But she absolutely insisted on doing what she did best. She insisted on developing this persona that a lot of people liked the look of but didn't want to listen to. Very similar to the Dolly Parton in a way, except Dolly Parton. I mean, I think she's a tremendous wit as well. It doesn't come across. Can't stand her music.
Dolly Parton,
love a bit.
Night at Night, come on.
I've got into a groove here.
Great song.
But come that, again.
Hey, someone, Jolene.
Oh, oh crap.
Bit cheap.
No, so it was a very that's sort of someone that I would like, if you like, I'm nothing like, but I really, really have a tremendous amount of admiration for her. What about you, Aisha?
I think my comedy hero is Woody Allen. I'm a massive, massive, massive Woody Allen fan. Apart from the paedophilia stuff, of course. but I think he's made, I think from, you know, when he sort of started as like his early stand-up is just, you know, fantastic. And I, again, he's somebody that drew from his heritage quite a lot, his like Jewish background, and I love that type of kind of humour. And I like the way he sort of evolved into his films, and I just think he's fantastic. I think he's very, very funny, but I think he's good at conveying kind of a message as well. So he's my comedy idol.
Is your comedy
I don't want anyone to be a comedian. I want my career to be brilliantly sparkling. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of people that I admire and I like what they do, but I don't, you know, I think Daniel Kitson is just a genius. He's just amazing, and I really admire his quickness of thought and his wit. That's, you know, people who are really quick and can just off the bat say stuff. I love sort of that kind of thing. But I don't think there's anyone whose career I really want, you know, I would never want to pigeon myself. I would have a pigeon.
As you do so frequently.
I do,
yeah.
It's a great thing to do. I wouldn't want to. You know, I don't see myself as a stand-up or an actress or a rock. You know, there's nothing.
Were you about to say a rock star?
Rock star. I'd love to be a rock star. Oh, you know what my dream is? I'd love to go on celebrity. What's that thing when they all sing?
Cat
TV. Yeah.
Stars in Your Eyes.
No. Yeah. The one on Fame Academy.
Fame Academy.
I'd love to do that.
What rock star would you be? Jimi Hendrix?
No one really.
Oh, crazy.
No.
Susie
Quattro.
Dolly Parton.
I'd love to be Dolly.
Dolly.
Oh, yeah, Dolly was a massive movie. Yeah, I know. I can get there. She did.
Exactly.
Have you seen her face recently? Oh. She's got, you know, she's got that famous mole, and it started up here, and it's now here. And that's true, you can see it. There's a picture of her from the 70s where it's here, and there's a picture of her now. It's literally moved up her face.
It's going to move up into the eyes. Yeah.
Basically kind of moved up as well.
But I'd love to do something like that, but I don't. There's so many people that I think are brilliant. There's so many. I'd love to do. Let's be like a really subversive sketch. I'm writing at the moment with the medic now, and we're writing some stuff, and I'd love to do something like that. They really. Pushing the boundaries of what's allowed on telly and what's allowed on stage and what people accept. And I don't think that necessarily means swearing, and I don't think it means being overtly sexual, but just, you know, I think we're afraid of the language of certain things, and I don't think we should censor anything. Everything should be out there, and then you choose whether you want to see it or not. And that's what I've got to do. And I suppose, I don't know who's done that. I suppose they're even gentle, and I'd love to work with someone like them. I think they're just brilliant because they don't go for what's laughed out loud funny necessarily. They just, you know, go for what they find amusing. Or they're so dark, kind of.
Very well done. Mm-hmm. So, quick round. Aisha, most honest. Oh, very, very good. Oh. And, Ruth? Split vote again. Mm-hmm. God, you two have been very good. Very, very good.
I'll tell a big lie.
Now, the next one, because both of you have got different elements of experience, is exposure in the media in your area. Do you think this helps your career? Does it make much of a difference? Does it move you forward? And if it does, how? Again, just to fill you in, I've done a bit of reality TV and I absolutely love the actual Zach Grace musical. Nobody saw it. It's on some satellite television every weekend apparently, but one person on the King's Road has come up to me for the recognition for it. But I really enjoyed the process. I found it absolutely fascinating, really. I improvised for 5 hours. Again, from my background, I was an alternative dweeb. I was pushing a gift shop and the premise of the show was to get fired by 3 o'clock. Not before, not after, and it was a fascinating thing. Very charming people in the shop, and trying to get them in a matter of 5 hours to loathe you so much that they sacked you an hour and a half early rather than wait till the end of the day.
And that process
was fantastic. Yes, I did.
What did you do to get sacked? What was the final thing that
I feng shuied, I yogied, I ommed, I talked the most unmitigated nonsense. I hate all that, obviously, from my background, I couldn't stand it. And finally, I said that they all look very energetic and bouncy. And by this time, they just loathed me intensely. And I said, you know what I've done? It's just a bit of an experiment. I've actually put a bit of urine in your tea this morning. And the manageress was still so sweet. She's gritting her teeth. And she said, I think it's absolutely disgusting to put waste products in other people's tea. And I said, I think it's a waste not to. In a very deep, deadpan way, and she just turned around and she said, please go. And it's about 30 seconds to go. So it was very, very successful. I don't really think any audience made any difference at all. I enjoyed the process. But on a general media sense, because you've had media exposure, Aisha, let's start with you. You've had a beginning on this one.
I've had a bit of media exposure. I won this awards. It was like Asian Women of Achievement Award, and I won the Young Achiever category. And I'm so glad I won it because I couldn't claim racism for once. You know, well, they're obviously clearly racist. I wasn't brown enough. That's why I didn't win it, kind of thing. And I did get some media sort of coverage after that, and because I was I worked for a government minister. I worked for she's now the health secretary, Patricia Hewitt. I got a bit of coverage for that my job, but I don't know how much it really helps you as a comedian to build. I mean, it's nice to get a bit of attention, but I don't think it really makes or breaks your sort of career, especially at this stage, because I'm still quite new. And at the end of the day, you're only as good as your performance is. And I think sometimes people who get a lot of media exposure quite early on in their career, they can risk kind of getting overexposed, and there can be quite a lot of hype about them, and then they sometimes don't match up to the expectations. So I think it's a nice addition. It's nice to get a bit of media attention, but I don't think it's a mainstay. I think if you're kind of at the stage that we are, the key thing is just to concentrate on getting better and not worry too much about your media profile, because that will come. If you get good, that will come. I mean, I do quite a lot of radio stuff as well, but that's just kind of, doing newspaper reviews and that kind of thing. That's not sort of, about me. So the small amount of media attention I've had has been nice, but it's been a total extra. It has not, I don't think, it's not harmed or kind of really boosted my kind of
promoter's life. They've heard of you.
Yeah, I think so. But then I do think your reputation is the strongest, bargaining tool that you've got for yourself, because at the end of the day, if you're a good comedian and if you get good reviews from people, other comedians who are quite credible comedians, that I think is a better reference than, I got a tiny little piece in a magazine. I really do think that's more important. And I know a lot of comedians who have been over, and not just comedians, other people as well. You can, if you get too much exposure early on in your career and you can't live up to it, it becomes a bad thing rather than it becomes rope to hang yourself with rather than a good thing. So,
Jersey and Mose was a very, very good friend of both of ours, and love us bits, but she's for years been saying she's the only female Muslim comic on the circuit, and the way she's coming up this year for the first time,
just had to drop her off deliberately. She now says the only good female Muslim comedian.
But yeah, there can be sort of types that you can use, but she's also had a
but she, yeah, that's a kind of an example where, you know, she's had a huge, huge amount of exposure. She's, you know, within about 2 years, she'd been on the David Letterman show, been on kind of big programs in America, yeah, 60 Minutes and that type of thing. And does feel that, you know, I mean, a quote that summed it up, someone reviewed to her and said that, and she feels the same as well. She said, I would like to be a good comedian as well as being a famous comedian, because, you know, there is a big difference between the two.
What about you, Rose?
I mean, I agree with Aisha. You've got to actually have the substance behind it. You know, there's lots of people who get hyped, and unless they've actually got any kind of substance, it's going to be a very quick, and then, you know, quick rise and then a quick fall, unless you've got something behind it. I mean, I was really lucky doing the show that I did.
Which was?
I did Sack You on Channel 4. It was great. It was a fantastic experience, and it was an amazing learning experience as well. I just adored it. It was just sitting talking with a bit like this, really. But, you know, just a bunch of comedians who you could just sit and have a laugh with, and, you know, it just happened there was an audience, and they put it out, you know, on TV. But it was the whole process was amazing to learn. It was just so interesting. But I don't think it's. I mean, it's definitely done. I've definitely got some stuff from it, but I think that what I've actually got from it is a confidence, and it is, there's a weirdness. When you've been on telly, I've been like 9 times, and there's a very strange thing with you walking along, and people talk to you that they know you, and I've heard so much up here, people going, hi, and I'm like, oh, hello, you know, and, oh, didn't I work with you in, and I really resist saying, no, you probably just saw me on the telly,
you
sound like
you knew who I am.
An idiot, you know, but the other side of that is if you don't say it and you let them guess for like 10 minutes about where they might have known you from, you're going, no, I don't think it was that. And then they either ask, oh, have you been on the telly or have you? And then they suddenly realise that's what they've seen. Then they feel really stupid and you feel really rude because you've just been letting them gather. It's a very odd situation to be in. Someone came up to me the other day and said, it's you, isn't it? And I went, yes. Is it you? Yeah, it's me. What? And it's very strange.
I get that with live audiences as well. I had a lot of people at my show yesterday, well, 7, that had been to see my show last year, and like, so they came to my show yesterday, and they were all like treating me like a long lost buddy, and I was just like, I have no idea who you are. They were really sweet, and like, I just vaguely had this memory that there was this group from Northern Ireland that was like, whatever. But it's very, I find it live or TV, there's this thing.
There is
what you want to create as a comic.
Yes, you want people to, you definitely want people to recognise you and want to see you again.
And also to feel that sense.
Feel that they know you in a way. But I don't know whether the actual media exposure is a good thing or a bad thing. In terms of what it's given me, you know, in terms of contacts, who I can now call on for. You know, if I've got something out there that I want to promote, then I've got great connections at Channel 4, great connections at Endemol, you know, and you just end up, but you only get those by, I think, by being, well, no, actually, I'm not good if I'm not doing good at what they do.
Surely not.
But I think in terms of the comedy, I think, in terms of the live circuit, you get more, from it by doing it, and the more people that see you, the more you get from it, rather than, you know, some magazine picking you up and saying this person is brilliant, and all that stuff is useful, but I don't think you can rely on it. I don't think you can just sit there and rest on your laurels and go, yeah, brilliant, I've been on Channel 4 my whole life, it's all, because it's very, as quickly as people recognise you, they'll forget you. So,
this is still a beer product, isn't it?
Yeah.
She said very cynically.
I might do that.
You might do that.
Yeah. Sell something else, you know what? Something really cheap.
A lot of these artists are quite good. Yeah, nobody knows where you're from, but they recognise the face.
Yeah.
Very good. So a quick vote. Who's been the most honest? Aisha Hazarika, Ruth Brett. Ruth again. Coming up in the ring. The next question is, again, I'll run it in a bit, is being, as we've got three panellists, I'm changing the format slightly, being female, does it hinder or help? In my case, I stand out in many, many respects for those who can't see me, and it's people know exactly who I am, they know my name stands out a bit, Sabrina George, and I stand out being a female comic, but sometimes ringing up promoters, one of the most irritating things is we've actually already got one female on the bill out of, say, seven comics, or sometimes you're a speciality act as a female, and I find that very frustrating. It's almost impossible to get a job emceeing some of the big clubs. They don't employ women to emcee. They don't consider we're tough enough or whatever enough. Or that's my view on the situation. And we're also, they have a common denominator, mainly from the audience actually, more than the promoters, is that we tend to talk about generic stuff which was used in the 80s, you know, female gynecological problems, man hatred and stuff like that, which I would say about 95% of the female comics I've ever worked with don't touch with a barge pole. The other 5%, it's actually men who tend to enjoy talking about subjects like that, not women. And I know a lot of female comics who talk about politics, who talk about things that are personal to them and don't actually touch these generic subjects, and yet it keeps on coming out again and again. It's very, very... I think we should be allowed to talk about them, and yet I find very few women actually particularly interested in talking about them, and yet we find it very difficult. I'm finding a lot of male comics who I consider not particularly good getting jobs that a lot of female friends of mine would do much better, and I'm kind of interested in what your view... I actually asked Ruth on that. What's your view on that?
I've got quite a few theories on females in comedy. I think the automatic assumption of a woman is that she's not going to be funny. Mm-hmm. A woman gets on the stage, she's got twice the work to do that a man has to do. The automatic assumption is that a man is going to be funny, and then if he's not, it's a disappointment. Whereas if a woman goes on, they're expecting her not to be funny, so she works twice as hard to get that first laugh, to get overheard and people expecting her not to be amusing. I also think men use comedy as in competition in a way women don't. If you see men talking to each other, they use comedy as one-upmanship.
Yeah.
And it's another way it's a kind of fighting thing. And I don't think women use that. Women use different things but they don't use humor in the same way men do. So there's not the same...
Gladiatorial.
It's not the same impulse to be funny. I think a lot of women are funny. I live with two of the funniest women in the world. They make me howl with laughter. And I don't think it's a male fashion at all. It is a male fashion. I don't think it's a male thing. I think women can be and are funny. But I think they often don't feel the need to. I also think that when you have a setup where the white middle class male is the standard, and it's still in comedy, and like you say, you know, they won't book more than one woman on a bill. God knows why, but they just don't. And I think in some ways it's a hindrance being female. I think in other ways it's a massive thing. Because there's this assumption that women aren't funny, if you are funny, you get much further, much quicker, in lots of ways, because people are always looking for a funny woman. You know, the reason why I got... the back view thing was, I mean, I really struggled to get it, but you know, they had me in like 7 times and I was doing the writing on it just so then they could get me into a pilot with them, you know, and it was this constant sort of, and when I was there, I was amazed by how male-centric the whole thing was. I mean, to the point of they were talking about how do you know it's a woman you have to be with a virgin, and I think, can we make that the person, just so I can join in the conversation? Because I can't, you know, and it was a question that they wanted us to write about. I'm like, I can't write about that because I've never slept with a woman, so I wouldn't know. But can we make, and they were going, well, how would you know if a man was? How would you do it, ridiculous? And I'm like, well, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, actually.
And you just kind of, there's this assumption that you know, that women are going to, I don't know, not know these, or not be interested, or not be, and then there's, you know, you talk about that the women always talking about opinions and you, like you say, women don't. How many male comics do you know who talk about sex and talk about masturbation?
Oh,
all these things. No one ever says, oh my god, that's all men talk about.
But, I was wanking in the mother wars.
Yeah, but it classic. Is. That, yeah. That's a yeah. classic one. And there's never, there's not the same, it makes me quite angry sometimes.
How do you deal with that, the anger? I kick a lot of furniture.
I was kind of, the way I look at it is I don't do anything about being a woman on stage. I never will because it doesn't interest me. But I think that the more I do, the more it's going to prove that women are funny and can make it. And the more women I meet, you know, who are funny, the more you can go, it's just ridiculous. The anger kind of comes out when you do something and you just get a real joy out of being right. Just the joy of being right. And it's tiny things. Like when I was doing Fat Q, there was a television screen in the green room, and there was a live feed from the studio into the green room, and there were two channels, one of which didn't have sound and one of which did. And the techie guy couldn't find it, and he had to run off and do something on the, you know, manager, he couldn't find it, and I said, "Oh, well, I'll find it." When I flipped through and I found the second channel, you know, he'd been told it was channel 17, and I think it was channel 15, but you know, he hadn't thought to look for channel 15. So I just flipped through, found it, and there it is. And one of the other guys went, "Oh, that's not it, there's no sound." Well, there is, it's just no one talking at the moment. That's why you can't hear anything. You can hear the buzz, there was, you know, you can hear a feedback. No, that's not it. Well, is it? Well, no, it can't be. So he flipped through, couldn't find it. And I'm like, it is, and is it that unbelievable that a female could have found a channel on a television that has sound? No, it's not unbelievable. And then when the sound came, I'm like,
smug as anything. I think it was about 6 weeks ago, I was doubling up in London doing gigs, and one gig, I was on in the middle. And every male, I was doing again, female on the bill, and I think there were about 8 comics, they all died, every single one of them. I went on, did extremely well, went off to the other gig, which was, I walked on to Stony Silence, the gig was Stone Dead. Had a great time, really got things going, went back to the first gig where some friends of mine were there, and saw the headliner completely dying on his ass. And these friends of mine said, you know, why aren't you headlining? And I said, okay, watch what happens. Everybody left, I sat there with the promotion, and I said, what should I do about getting another gig? And he said, oh, email me in 3 months' time. I'm booking about 3 months from that point, so i.e. I was going to get another gig possibly in 6 months' time. All the comics that I had, that had died in front of me, got gigs within 6 weeks. And I found that very, very difficult not to go and kick his head in. But having these two people as witness to the situation was fantastic. These friends of mine, they just literally had their mouth open with his response. And I do find that quite difficult. And I have to keep working to set that aside, you know, acknowledge that it is true and it is real, but set it aside and move on.
Well, I think there are a lot of people, I think a lot of it is changing. I do think it's changing. It's not changing very fast, but it is. You know, things like funny women, it's awful that you have to have a competition just for women, but I don't think you do have to, but it's very interesting. I think it's a very interesting comment on gender, and I'd love to have an intellectual debate about it, but unfortunately it always descends
into you're just bitter.
You're just a bitter woman.
Have some chocolate, yeah, have my chocolate. Lipstick, it'll be fine. It'll be fine, love. Go and have a cake.
Yeah.
What about you, Aisha?
It just makes me so angry because I everything that Ruth has said, everything that you've said, I completely concur with. And there is this nervousness when a woman walks onto a stage at a comedy club, there is a tension, and that tension comes from not just men in the audience, women in the audience as well. Like, women look scared for you when you walk onto stage. And I think there's this big thing. Well, the other thing is, because you're the only one, if they were like, it's such a joke, there's a big difference. If you're the only woman on the bill, and if there's one other woman, you instantly feel more relaxed. Like you do feel a bit of pressure's off you because, you know, you kind of come on as a slightly like novelty act as the kind of one woman. Whereas if there's two, people are a bit better about it. And I, one of the first gigs I did at the Comedy Store, a woman opened, and I was meant to go on second. And it was my first gig at the Comedy Store. I was so nervous. And I was just about to go on stage, and the sort of floor manager came running through and went, "Stop!" Like in slow motion, kind of like running towards me. And I was like, "What?" And he's going, "You, there's been a massive cock up. You can't go on. We've made a massive mistake. We've got two women on the bill tonight." And he was going, "It's bad enough we've got two on the same bill, but there's absolutely no way you can go on. You're going to have to wait and go on at the end when people have forgotten that there's been like a woman on. Hopefully they'll be too drunk."
She's been like,
"What?
You find that you're like, I'm not up here for womankind. So as soon as you go on as the only woman on the bill, you're not just going on to be funny. You're going on to be funny for women."
Yes.
You know, I don't want to be funny for women. I'm not here as some kind of, you know,
representative of the gender. It's just, and I don't know what the fear is. I think the fear is we'll synchronise and start like bleeding all over. Turn into like a bloodbath, just kind of Kill Bill, kind of like, just sorry. And I hate it so much because there is this real kind of, there are certain subjects which you cannot mention. If you ever dared mention, like, you know, vibrators, gynecological things, pews, anything about your sex, if you ever mentioned it on stage, boo, get off, hack, hack, hack. And last night I sat through 3 hours of comedy of man after man going on and going, tossing myself off, and just 3 hours of wanking jokes. Just unbelievable.
And pedophile priests.
Yeah, pedophile jokes, wanking jokes, raping a woman joke. That was a really nice one. That kind of computer game. So, and you just think,
raping
this is
a woman.
Yeah. Just, it's just not, it's not. Oh, it's great, it's a classic. A man walks into a bar, it's a woman, and this guy was just getting, like, kind of rapturous, sort of, you know, wasn't he just thinking, if a woman had gone, and then one woman did go on stage last night, a friend of ours, Zoe, and she was probably the best comic up there, and really struggled. I mean, she did turn the gig round, but it's very, very, very male. It's very male, and I just find it unfair, because I think there should be nothing you can't talk about in comedy. Technically, anything should be funny. That's what comedy is about. It's about removing all barriers and obstacles. Everything's up for discussion. And it does seem rather unfair that for female comedians, you have a huge part of your life. And a lot of comedy is about your own experiences and your own observations. And it is just a shame that there's like a huge amount of information that we're just not allowed to ever draw on because it would be perceived as really bad form.
Well, and also I think what's interesting is that women are supposed to go to comedy clubs and watch male comedians talking about things that are essentially male-based humour,
yeah,
that men make jokes about being men. And women are supposed to laugh at that. But if a woman makes a joke about fundamentally based around being female,
yeah,
men aren't supposed to laugh at that. Men aren't supposed to be able to find that funny. Well, why? Every man has got a mother.
Yeah.
You know, so they know women at some level. And it is...
I think it's not just the subject matter. I also find things like If You're in the Store or John Glenn's, or the very big clubs, which have a lot of pressure put on you as a comic. You go into the green room and you'll find the promoter, the techie, the sound guy, the bouncers, the ticket office person, and all the other comics are men, and you're going there as the only female. And
oh, there was, and it's so true.
I would love to create the reverse environment for some of the male comics where
in the Comedy Store, they've got this like kind of, it's like a green room, and it's so male. It smells of balls when you go in. It's like a locker room, and they've got a toilet sort of near the and it's, you would just, as a woman, you would never want to go into that toilet. I mean, it's just, it's so male. It just smells like, you go in there and it's testosterone kind of city. And I remember like going, I really want to put some lipstick on, but I'm too embarrassed. So I was like, go on, be brave. And everyone's like, oh, for God's sake. And it was just like really kind of,
I haven't washed for a week, what's wrong with that?
Oh, it's awful. But it does annoy me that I would love to have a competition to get loads of female queens just for someone to come up with the funniest period joke they could imagine.
Yeah.
Just to stick two fingers up at the fact that you can't, that's probably like the worst thing you could ever mention on stage as a female comedian. Yet, I've seen so many male comedians do jokes about periods.
I know, they do it more than women do.
Yeah.
And they're allowed to. Why are they allowed to? And we're not.
I think a lot of it is a social thing, but it's still, I think, it's what you were saying at the start, it's still countercultural for, for women to be seen as the kind of really funny ones. Even
I think we're revolutionaries.
What? I think things are changing slowly.
I mean, the weird thing about it is that, you know, in the 80s, you have really big female comedians.
Joe Brand.
They're physically large. But, I mean, no, I mean, you have, you know, you've got French and Saunders, Jenny Clare, Joe Brand, Victoria Wood. Loads of female comedians who really made an amazing career out of comedy and have made a lot of money out of comedy.
Mm.
And yet still, 20-plus years later, 25 years later, women are still having the same...
Honestly, Ruth, Aisha, look, we're on even Stevens, you've both won.
Hey!
Now we've literally got 4 minutes for any question and answer. Does anybody want to ask any questions? Of what would you like to ask?
Two parts. First of all, where was Aisha?
Aisha was
in
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was I born? I was born in a place called Bells Hill, which is just outside Glasgow. Yeah.
Yeah. Do
I object to it?
Well,
it's interesting because I got I did get asked about this. I did something independent because there was this thing about should I think one of the ministers sort of said should Britons British Asians rebrand themselves? I think you should be able to define yourself in a way that makes you feel comfortable. I see myself as having almost like a triple sort of identity. I see myself as being Glaswegian, I see myself as being Indian, and I see myself as being British. And I feel very lucky to have those kind of three things. And I think I'm really pleased with the decision that my mum and dad took in terms of how they brought me up, because I feel I've had a really positive experience growing up, certainly in Scotland, where I was kind of, I was never questioned in terms of like what I was meant to be. What do you mean?
Focus on performing, please, rather than politics. What would you like to... In my experience, a lot of people who claim luck are actually lying. I find that there's some extraordinarily talented, and they are genuinely talented, but in my experience, the more I've got to know performers, and this is in all arenas, the more I've realised that they, which is a question we haven't got time for, but how much do we plan our careers? But people who talk about, I was really lucky, in my experience, that's never true. They've always worked incredibly hard behind the scenes, and the purpose of basically what comics do is to make it look as effortless as possible. And part of that illusion, if you like, is to claim luck and whatever. But the ones that... I would say, without exception, even some people who I don't particularly like their comedy, I know how hard they work behind the scenes to get where they want to be. And exactly, and the harder you work, the luckier you become.
So we are seeing that, you know, the top of the people who are professional, see the talent, and their comics or whatever, those are the best.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Not really the best, but they might have worked the hardest.
You might see them at stages of achieving their best.
Well, but you don't get a good agent unless you're good. Yeah. I mean, you don't just suddenly get an agent. It's difficult to get
but
an agent.
But agents will often take people on who have that illusion.
Yeah.
And then the agents have to drop them because they're not prepared to write new material. They're not prepared to turn up on a Monday morning to do a show, a Monday afternoon. There are lots of comics who are extremely talented. I can't tell you how I run a small club in London, and I come across a comic, and I sit there and go, you're brilliant! Why can't you get out of bed? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think the luck thing is a bit of a fallacy. I think kind of luck is basically lots of preparation meeting a moment of opportunity.
Yes.
That's what I really, really believe.
I agree.
Because, you know, everyone at different points in their career and their life will have breaks, and it's how you kind of convert those breaks into something really big, and that comes down to your own talent and your own preparation.
And also your own drive to do it. Because a lot of people are brilliant, but are never going to get anywhere because, you know, they don't have the drive to get where they need to go. You can't just sit, sit back and wait for it to happen.
Yeah.
And so luck is actually that there is a point where, you know, you might meet someone and it might be quite fortuitous, but it's never luck. It's never, you know, you're never just suddenly going to be thrown into the spotlight unless you put in the work and unless afterwards you continue to win.
It's not ever going to be effortless.
No, never, never.
And often luck can come your way if you're not prepared for it. You don't see it as lucky. But, you know, without going into the deep structure of comedy, to get paid gigs, you need about 20 minutes of material. And I knew one comic who I thought was extraordinarily talented when I started, and he never, for 4 years, he'd operated on 10 minutes of material. He was very funny, he was very engaging, he was very charming, and he was very good at turning for gigs on time. He could not get that 10 minutes written, and he's now been going 9 years, I think, and he's become a TV presenter, which is great, because he, you know, can use his facilities in another way. And in a way, you would say that's lucky, but he could not write material. And there's lots of comics like that. He will stay at places like the Comedy Store for years. Not so much the Comedy Store, actually, more jongleurs. And you will see them 10 years ago, 10 years in the future, and he'll do the same 10 years of material. It's very unlikely that luck is going to strike them. If they're doing like a revolving set of material constantly, and they're constantly breaking the boundaries of what they do and extending what they do, I think luck is more likely to arrive at their doorstep. Is that a full answer for you?
That was Gandalf-like.
Anybody else here with any questions? Can I ask you,
what do you think about the loss of the musical?
That's nothing I have any experience of, I'm afraid. I'm here to answer questions. I can't really answer a question I don't know.
Well, you understand what I'm saying? Is that there's a thing called musical that used to go around the country. You've got all of them, but at least you've got comedians and whatever else you want. But nowadays, how do you get to see people like you if you don't come into the provinces?
We're in the provinces all the time.
I think it's sort of less.
To the problem with women. There are comedy clubs in just about every single town.
But there is no. I think it's got a bit of point because there is actually a bit of a resurgence in more kind of music hall type performances.
Variety
and things like the Hackney Empire in London.
That's what I'm talking about.
They're having
all the cities have these things. And all right, you've got comedians on. Indeed, the public would go, all right, saying that there are comedy, whatever it is, in the main cities. I've got no idea.
That's true, actually. You do need to be in the know of it. You do need to be a bit in the know.
There's a load, but I'm telling you, I don't know of one.
I don't know how to help you with that.
Yeah. Go on to Chortle.
Go on to Chortle.
That's your problem, because you're not promoting, are you?
Well, I don't think that's true. I think there's a massive difference between what musical is and what stand-up comedy does. There are always comedians within musical, but it's very different. It's actually a very different genre. It doesn't get the fish and the sea. There was some stand-up involved in it, but I think...
Can we wind this up, because we've got another show coming in 10 minutes. Thank you very much for your contribution. Hand up. Round of applause.